They didn't sound like very nice people. She wondered what their response would be. The red ink looked like blood against the white paper. Frowning, Hodge Starkweather rolled the letter, carefully and meticulously, into the shape of a tube and whistled for Hugo. The bird, cawing softly, settled on his wrist. Hodge winced. Years ago in the uprising, he had sustained a wound to that shoulder, and even as light a weight as Hugo's, or the turn of a season, a change in temperature, humidity, too sudden a movement of his arm, awakened old twinges and the memories of pains better forgotten. There were some memories, though, that never faded. Images burst like flashbulbs behind his lids when he closed his eyes. Blood and bodies, trampled earth, a white podium stained with red, the cries of the dying. The green and rolling fields of Idris and its endless blue sky pierced by the towers of the glass city. The pain of loss surged up inside him like a wave. He tightened his fist, and Hugo, wings fluttering, pecked angrily at his fingers, drawing blood. Opening his hand, Hodge released the bird, who circled his head as he flew up to the skylight and then vanished. Shaking off his sense of foreboding, Hodge reached for another piece of paper, not noticing the scarlet drops that smeared the paper as he wrote.
This ends Disc 2. City of Bones, Disc 3.
6. Forsaken. The weapons room looked exactly the way something called the weapons room sounded like it would look. Brushed metal walls were hung with every manner of sword, dagger, spike, pike, featherstaff, bayonet, whip, mace, hook, and bow. Soft leather bags filled with arrows dangled from hooks, and there were stacks of boots, leg guards, and gauntlets for wrists and arms. The place smelled of metal and leather and steel polish. Alec and Jace, no longer barefoot, sat at a long table in the center of the room, their heads bent over an object between them. Jace looked up as the door shut behind Clary. "Where's Hodge?" he said. "Writing to the Silent Brothers." Alec repressed a shudder. "Ugh." She approached the table slowly, conscious of Alec's gaze. "What are you doing? Putting the last touches on these?" Jace moved aside so she could see what lay on the table. 3 long, slim wands of a dully glowing silver. They did not look sharp or particularly dangerous. Sanvi, Sansanvi, and Smongolov. They're serif blades. "Those don't look like knives. How do you make them? Magic?" Alec looked horrified, as if she'd asked him to put on a tutu and execute a perfect pirouette. "The funny thing about Mundies," Jace said to nobody in particular, "is how obsessed with magic they are for a bunch of people who don't even know what the word means." "I know what it means," Clary snapped. "No, you don't. You just think you do. Magic is a dark and elemental force, not just a lot of sparkly wands and crystal balls and talking goldfish." "I never said it was a lot of talking goldfish. You..." Jace waved a hand, cutting her off. "Just because you call an electric eel a rubber duck doesn't make it a rubber duck, does it? And God help the poor bastard who decides that they want to take a bath with the ducky." "You're driveling," Clary observed.
"I'm not," said Jace with great dignity.
"Yes, you are," said Alec, rather unexpectedly. "Look, we don't do magic, okay?" he added, not looking at Clary. "That's all you need to know about it." Clary wanted to snap at him, but restrained herself. Alec already didn't seem to like her. There was no point in aggravating his hostility. She turned to Jace. "Hodge said I can go home." Jace nearly dropped the serif blade he was holding.
"He said what?"
"To look through my mother's things," she amended. "If you go with me."
"Jace," Alec exhaled, but Jace ignored him.
"If you really want to prove that my mom or dad was a shadow hunter, we should look through my mom's things. What's left of them?"
"Down the rabbit hole." Jace grinned crookedly. "Good idea. If we go right now, we should have another 3-4 hours of daylight."
"Do you want me to come with you?" Alec asked as Clary and Jace moved toward the door. Clary glanced back at him. He was half out of the chair, eyes expectant.
No. Jace didn't turn around. That's all right. Clary and I can handle this on our own.
The look Alex shot Clary was as sour as poison. She was glad when the door shut behind her. Jace led the way down the hall, Clary half jogging to keep up with his long-legged stride.
Have you got your house keys?
Clary glanced down at her shoes.
Yeah.
Good. Not that we couldn't break in, but we'd run a greater chance of disturbing any wards that might be up if we did.
If you say so.
The hall widened out into a marble-floored foyer, a black metal gate set into one wall. It was only when Jace pushed a button next to the gate and it lit up that she realized it was an elevator. It creaked and groaned as it rose to meet them.
Jace?
Yeah?
How did you know I had Shadowhunter blood? Was there some way you could tell?
The elevator arrived with a final groan. Jace unlatched the gate and slid it open. The inside reminded Clary of a birdcage, all black metal and decorative bits of gilt.
I guessed, he said, latching the door behind them. It seemed like the most likely explanation.
You guessed? You must have been pretty sure, considering you could have killed me. He pressed a button in the wall, and the elevator lurched into action with a vibrating groan that she felt all through the bones in her feet.
I was 90% sure.
I see, Clary said. There must have been something in her voice, because he turned to look at her. Her hand cracked across his face, a slap that rocked him back on his heels. He put his hand to his cheek, more in surprise than pain.
What the hell was that for?
The other 10%, she said, and they rode the rest of the way down to the street in silence. Jay spent the train ride to Brooklyn wrapped in an angry silence. Clary stuck close to him anyway, feeling a little bit guilty, especially when she looked at the red mark her slap had left on his cheek. She didn't really mind the silence. It gave her a chance to think. She kept reliving the conversation with Luke over and over in her head. It hurt to think about, like biting down on a broken tooth, but she couldn't stop doing it. Farther down the train, two teenage girls sitting on an orange bench seat were giggling together. The sort of girls Clary had never liked at St. Xavier's, sporting pink jelly mules and fake tans. Clary wondered for a moment if they were laughing at her, before she realized with a start of surprise that they were looking at Jace. She remembered the girl in the coffee shop who had been staring at Simon. Girls always got that look on their faces when they thought someone was cute. She had nearly forgotten that Jace was cute, given everything that had happened. He didn't have Alex's delicate cameo looks, but Jace's face was more interesting. In daylight, his eyes were the color of golden syrup and were looking right at her. He cocked an eyebrow.
Can I help you with something?
Clary turned instant traitor against her gender. Those girls on the other side of the car are staring at you. Jace assumed an air of mellow gratification.
Of course they are, he said. I am stunningly attractive.
Haven't you ever heard that modesty is an attractive trait?
Only from ugly people, Jace confided.
The meek may inherit the earth, but at the moment, it belongs to the conceited, like me.
He winked at the girls, who giggled and hid behind their hair. Clary sighed.
How come they can see you?
Glamours are a pain to use. Sometimes we don't bother.
The incident with the girls on the train did seem to put him in a better mood. When they left the station and headed up the hill to Clary's apartment, he took one of the serif blades out of his pocket and started flipping it back and forth between his fingers and across his knuckles, humming to himself.
Do you have to do that? Clary asked. It's annoying.
Jace hummed louder. It was a loud, tuneful sort of hum, somewhere between Happy Birthday and the Battle Hymn of the Republic. I'm sorry I smacked you, she said. He stopped humming.
Just be glad you hit me and not Alec. He would have hit you back.
He seems to be itching for the chance, Clary said, kicking an empty soda can out of her path.
What was it that Alec called you? Para something?
Parabatai, said Jace. It means a pair of warriors who fight together, who were closer than brothers. Alec is more than just my best friend. My father and his father were Parabatai when they were young. His father was my godfather. That's why I live with him. They're my adopted family. But your last name isn't Lightwood.
No, Jace said, and she would have asked what it was, but they arrived at her house and her heart had started to thump so loudly that she was sure it must be audible for miles. There was a humming in her ears, and the palms of her hands were damp with sweat. She stopped in front of the box hedges and raised her eyes slowly, expecting to see yellow police tape cordoning off the front door, smashed glass littering the lawn, the whole thing reduced to rubble. But there were no signs of destruction. Bathed in pleasant afternoon light, the brownstone seemed to glow. Bees droned lazily around the rose bushes under Madame Dorothea's windows.
It looks the same, Clary said.
On the outside.
Jace reached into his jeans pockets and drew out another one of the metal and plastic contraptions she'd mistaken for a cell phone.
So that's a sensor? What does it do? She asked.
It picks up frequencies like a radio does, but these frequencies are demonic in origin.
Demon shortwave?
Something like that. Jace held the sensor out in front of him as he approached the house. It clicked faintly as they climbed the stairs, then stopped. Jace frowned. It's picking up some trace activity, but that could just be left over from that night. I'm not getting anything strong enough for there to be demons present now. Clary let out a breath she hadn't realized she'd been holding.
Good.
She bent to retrieve her keys. When she straightened up, she saw the scratches on the front door. It must have been too dark for her to have seen them last time. They looked like claw marks, long and parallel, raked deeply into the wood.
Jace touched her arm.
I'll go first, he said. Clary wanted to tell him that she didn't need to hide behind him, but the words wouldn't come. She could taste the terror she'd felt when she'd first seen the Ravener. The taste was sharp and coppery on her tongue like old pennies. He pushed the door open with one hand, beckoning her after him with the hand that held the sensor. Once inside the entryway, Clary blinked, adjusting her eyes to the dimness. The bulb overhead was still out, the skylight too filthy to let in any light, and shadows lay thick across the chipped floor. Madame Dorothea's door was firmly shut. No light showed through the gap under it. Clary wondered uneasily if anything had happened to her. Jace raised his hand and ran it along the banister. It came away wet, streaked with something that looked blackish red in the dim light.
Blood.
Maybe it's mine. Her voice sounded tinny. From the other night.
It'd be dry by now if it were, Jace said. Come on.
He headed up the stairs, Clary close behind him. The landing was dark, and she fumbled her keys three times before she managed to slide the right one into the lock. Jace leaned over her, watching impatiently.
Don't breathe down my neck, she hissed.
Her hand was shaking. Finally, the tumblers caught, the lock clicking open. Jace pulled her back. I'll go in first. She hesitated, then stepped aside to let him pass. Her palms were sticky, and not from the heat. In fact, it was cool inside the apartment, almost cold, chilly air seeped from the entryway, stinging her skin. She felt goosebumps rising as she followed Jace down the short hallway and into the living room. It was empty. Startlingly, entirely empty, the way it had been when they'd first moved in. The walls and floor bare, the furniture gone, even the curtains torn down from the windows. Only faint, lighter squares of paint on the wall showed where her mother's paintings had hung. As if in a dream, Clary turned and walked toward the kitchen, Jace pacing her, his light eyes narrowed. The kitchen was just as empty, even the refrigerator gone, the chairs, the table. The kitchen cabinet stood open, their bare shelves reminding her of a nursery rhyme. She cleared her throat.
What would demons, she said, want with our microwave?
Jace shook his head, mouth curling under at the corners.
I don't know, but I'm not sensing any demonic presence right now. I'd say they're long gone.
She glanced around one more time. Someone had cleaned up the spilled Tabasco sauce, she noticed distantly.
Are you satisfied? Jace asked. There's nothing here. She shook her head. I want to see my room. He looked as if he were about to say something, then thought better of it.
If that's what it takes, he said, sliding the serif blade into his pocket.
The light in the hallway was out, but Clary didn't need much light to navigate inside her own house. With Jace just behind her, she found the door to her bedroom and reached for the knob. It was cold in her hand, so cold it nearly hurt, like touching an icicle with your bare skin. She saw Jace look at her quickly, but she was already turning the knob, or trying to. It moved slowly, almost stickily, as if the other side of it were embedded in something glutinous and syrupy. The door blew outward, knocking her off her feet. She skidded across the hallway floor and slammed into the wall, rolling onto her stomach. There was a dull roaring in her ears as she pulled herself up to her knees. Jace, flat against the wall, was fumbling in his pocket, his face a mask of surprise. Looming over him like a giant in a fairy tale was an enormous man, big around as an oak tree, a broad-bladed axe clutched in one gigantic, dead white hand. Tattered, filthy rags hung off his grimy skin, and his hair was a single matted tangle thick with dirt. He stank of poisonous sweat and rotting flesh. Clary was glad she couldn't see his face. The back of him was bad enough. Jace had the serif blade in his hand. He raised it, calling out, Sansanvi! A blade shot from the tube. Clary thought of old movies where bayonets were hidden inside walking sticks released at the flick of a switch, but she'd never seen a blade like this before. Clear as glass, with a glowing hilt, wickedly sharp and nearly as long as Jace's forearm. He struck out, slashing at the gigantic man who staggered back with a bellow. Jace whirled around, racing toward her. He caught her arm, hauling her to her feet, pushing her ahead of him down the hall. She could hear the thing behind them following. Its footsteps sounded like lead weights being dropped onto the floor, but it was coming on fast. They sped through the entryway and out onto the landing, Jace whipping around to slam the front door shut. She heard the click of the automatic lock and caught her breath. The door shook on its hinges as a tremendous blow struck against it from inside the apartment. Clary backed away to the stairs. Jace glanced at her. His eyes were glowing with manic excitement. Get downstairs! Get out of the... Another blow came, and this time the hinges gave way and the door flew outward. It would have knocked Jace over if he hadn't moved so fast that Clary barely saw it. Suddenly, he was on the top stair, the blade burning in his hand like a fallen star. She saw Jace look at her and shout something, but she couldn't hear him over the roar of the gigantic creature that burst from the shattered door, making straight for him. She flattened herself against the wall as it passed in a wave of heat and stink, and then its axe was flying, whipping through the air, slicing toward Jace's head. He ducked, and it thunked heavily into the banister, biting deep. Jace laughed. The laugh seemed to enrage the creature. Abandoning the axe, he lurched at Jace with his enormous fists raised. Jace brought the serif blade around in an arcing sweep, burying it to the hilt in the giant's shoulder. For a moment, the giant stood swaying. Then he lurched forward, his hands outstretched and grasping. Jace stepped aside hastily, but not hastily enough. The enormous fist caught hold of him as the giant staggered and fell, dragging Jace in his wake. Jace cried out once. There was a series of heavy and cracking thumps and then silence. Clary scrambled to her feet and raced downstairs. Jace lay sprawled at the foot of the steps, his arm bent beneath him at an unnatural angle. Across his legs lay the giant, the hilt of Jace's blade protruding from his shoulder. He was not quite dead, but flopping weakly, a bloody froth leaking from his mouth. Clary could see his face now. It was dead white and papery, latticed with a black network of horrible scars that almost obliterated his features. His eye sockets were red, suppurating pits. Fighting the urge to gag, Clary stumbled down the last few stairs, stepped over the twitching giant, and knelt down next to Jace. He was so still. She laid a hand on his shoulder, felt his shirt sticky with blood. His own or the giant's, she couldn't tell. Jace? His eyes opened. Is it dead? Almost, Clary said grimly. Hell, He winced. My legs. Hold still. Crawling around to his head, Clary slipped her hands under his arms and pulled. He grunted with pain as his legs slipped out from under the creature's spasming carcass. Clary let go and he struggled to his feet, his left arm across his chest. She stood up. Is your arm all right?
No, broken, he said.
Can you reach into my pocket? She hesitated, nodded. Which one?
Inside jacket, right side. Take out one of the serif blades and hand it to me.
He held still as she nervously slipped her fingers into his pocket. She was standing so close that she could smell the scent of him, sweat and soap and blood. His breath tickled the back of her neck. Her fingers closed on a tube and she drew it out, not looking at him.
Thanks, he said. His fingers traced it briefly before he named it. Sanvi. Like its predecessor, the tube grew into a wicked-looking dagger, its glow illuminating his face. Don't watch, he said, going to stand over the scarred thing's body. He raised the blade over his head and brought it down. Blood fountained from the giant's throat, splattering Jace's boots. She half expected the giant to vanish, folding in on itself the way the kid in Pandemonium had, but it didn't. The air was full of the smell of blood, heavy and metallic. Jace made a sound low in his throat. He was white-faced, whether with pain or disgust, she couldn't tell.
I told you not to watch, he said.
I thought it would disappear, she said. Back to its own dimension, you said.
I said that's what happens to demons when they die. Wincing, he shrugged his jacket off his shoulder, burying the upper part of his left arm. That wasn't a demon.
With his right hand, he drew something out of his belt. It was the smooth, wand-shaped object he used to carve those overlapping circles into Clary's skin. Looking at it, she felt her forearm begin to burn. Jace saw her staring and grinned the ghost of a grin.
This, he said, is a stele. He touched it to an inked mark just below his shoulder, a curious shape almost like a star. Two arms of the star jutted out from the rest of the mark, unconnected. And this, he said, is what happens when shadow hunters are wounded. With the tip of the stele, he traced a line connecting the two arms of the star. When he lowered his hand, the mark was shining as if it had been etched with phosphorescent ink. As Clary watched, it sank into his skin like a weighted object sinking into water. It left behind a ghostly reminder, a pale, thin scar almost invisible. An image rose in Clary's mind. Her mother's back, not quite covered by her bathing suit top, the blades of her shoulders and curves of her spine dappled with narrow, white marks. It was like something she had seen in a dream. Her mother's back didn't really look like that, she knew, but the image nagged at her. Jace let out a sigh, the tense look of pain leaving his face. He moved the arm slowly at first, then more easily, lifting it up and down, clenching his fist. Clearly, it was no longer broken. That's amazing, Clary said. How did you... That was in Eratze, a healing rune, Jace said. Finishing the rune with the stele activates it. He shoved the slim wand into his belt and shrugged his jacket back on. With the toe of his boot, he prodded the giant's corpse. We're going to have to report this to Hodge, he said. He'll freak out, he added, as if the thought of Hodge's alarm gave him some satisfaction. Jace, Clary thought, was the sort of person who liked it when things were happening, even things that were bad. Why will he freak out? Clary said. And I get that that thing isn't a demon, that's why the sensor didn't register, right? Jace nodded. You see the scars all over its face? Yes. Those were made with the stele, like this one. He tapped the wand in his belt. You ask me what happens when you carve marks onto someone who doesn't have Shadow Hunter blood? Just one mark will only burn you, but lots of marks, powerful ones, carved into the flesh of a totally ordinary human being with no trace of Shadow Hunter ancestry, you get this. He jerked his chin at the corpse. The runes are agonizingly painful. The marked ones go insane,
The pain drives them out of their minds. They become fierce, mindless killers. They don't sleep or eat unless you make them, and they die usually quickly. Runes have great power and can be used to do great good, but they can also be used for evil. The Forsaken are evil. Clary stared at him in horror. But why would anyone do that to themselves?
Nobody would. It's something that gets done to them. By a warlock, maybe, some downworlder gone bad. The Forsaken are loyal to the one who marked them, and they're fierce killers. They can obey simple commands, too. It's like having a slave army.
He stepped over the dead Forsaken and glanced over his shoulder at her. I'm going back upstairs.
But there's nothing there.
There might be more of them, he said, almost as if he were hoping there would be. You should wait here. He started up the steps.
I wouldn't do that if I were you, said a shrill and familiar voice. There are more of them where the first one came from.
Jace, who was nearly at the top of the stairs, spun and stared. So did Clary, although she knew immediately who had spoken. That gravelly accent was unmistakable.
Madame Dorothea?
The old woman inclined her head regally. She stood in the doorway of her apartment, dressed in what looked like a tent made of raw purple silk. Gold chains glittered on her wrists and roped her throat. Her long, badger-striped hair straggled from the bun pinned to the top of her head. Jace was still staring.
But more what? Clary said.
More Forsaken, replied Dorothea with a cheerfulness that Clary felt didn't really fit the circumstances. She glanced around the entryway.
You have made a mess, haven't you? I'm sure you weren't planning on cleaning up either.
Typical. But you're a mundane, Jace said, finally finishing his sentence.
So observant, said Dorothea, her eyes gleaming. The clave really broke the mold with you.
The bewilderment on Jace's face was fading, replaced by a dawning anger. You know about the clave? He demanded. You knew about them and you knew they were Forsaken in this house and you didn't notify them? Just the existence of Forsaken is a crime against the Covenant.
Neither clave nor Covenant have ever done anything for me, said Madame Dorothea, her eyes flashing angrily. I owe them nothing.
For a moment, her gravelly New York accent vanished, replaced with something else. A thicker, deeper accent that Clary didn't recognize.
Jace, stop it, Clary said.
She turned to Madame Dorothea. If you know about the clave and the Forsaken, she said, then maybe you know what happened to my mother. Dorothea shook her head, her earrings swinging. There was something like pity on her face.
My advice to you, she said, is to forget about your mother. She's gone.
The floor under Clary seemed to tilt.
You mean she's dead?
No. Dorothea spoke the word almost reluctantly.
I'm sure she's still alive, for now.
Then I have to find her, Clary said. The world had stopped tilting. Jace was standing behind her, his hand on her elbow as if to brace her, but she barely noticed. You understand? I have to find her before... Madame Dorothea held up a hand.
I don't want to involve myself in Shadow Hunter business.
But you knew my mother. She was your neighbor.
This is an official clave investigation, Jace cut her off. I can always come back with the Silent Brothers.
Oh, for the... Dorothea glanced at her door, then at Jace and Clary.
I suppose you might as well come in, she said finally. I'll tell you what I can.
She started toward the door, then halted on the threshold, glaring.
But if you tell anyone I helped you, Shadow Hunter, you'll wake up tomorrow with snakes for hair and an extra pair of arms.
That might be nice, an extra pair of arms, Jace said, handy in a fight.
Not if they're growing out of your...
Dorothea paused and smiled at him, not without malice.
Neck.
Yikes, said Jace mildly.
Yikes is right, Jace Wayland.
Dorothea marched into the apartment, her purple tent flying around her like a gaudy flag. Clary looked at Jace.
Wayland?
It's my name,
Jace looked shaken. I can't say I like that she knows it. Clary glanced after Dorothea. The lights were on inside the apartment. Already the heavy smell of incense was flooding the entryway, mixing unpleasantly with the stench of blood. Still, I think we might as well try talking to her. What have we got to lose?
Once you spend a bit more time in our world, Jace said, you won't ask me that again.
7. The five-dimensional door. Madame Dorothea's apartment seemed to have roughly the same layout as Clary's, though she'd made a very different use of the space. The entryway, reeking of incense, was hung with bead curtains and astrological posters. One showed the constellations of the zodiac, another a guide to Chinese magical symbols, and another showed a hand with fingers spread, each line on the palm carefully labeled. Above the hand, Latinate script spelled out the words, In Manibus Fortuna. Narrow shelves holding stacked books ran along the wall beside the door. One of the bead curtains rattled, and Madame Dorothea poked her head through.
Interested in chiromancy? She said, noting Clary's gaze. Or just nosy?
Neither, Clary said. Can you really tell fortunes?
My mother had a great talent. She could see a man's future in his hand or the leaves at the bottom of his teacup. She taught me some of her tricks.
She transferred her gaze to Jace.
Speaking of tea, young man, would you like some?
What? Jace said, looking flustered.
Tea. I find it both settles the stomach and concentrates the mind. Wonderful drink, tea.
I'll have tea, Clary said, realizing how long it had been since she'd eaten or drunk anything. She felt as if she'd been running on pure adrenaline since she woke up. Jace succumbed.
All right, as long as it isn't Earl Grey, he added, wrinkling his fine bone nose. I hate bergamot.
Madame Dorothea cackled loudly and disappeared back through the bead curtain, leaving it swaying gently behind her. Clary raised her eyebrows at Jace.
You hate bergamot?
Jace had wandered over to the narrow bookshelf and was examining its contents.
You have a problem with that?
You may be the only guy my age I've ever met who knows what bergamot is, much less that it's in Earl Grey tea.
Yes, well, Jace said with a supercilious look, I'm not like other guys.
Besides, he added, flipping a book off the shelf, at the Institute we have to take classes in basic medicinal uses for plants. It's required.
I figured all your classes were stuff like Slaughter 101 and Beheading for Beginners.
Jace flipped a page.
Very funny, Frey.
Clary, who had been studying the palmistry poster, whirled on him. Don't call me that. He glanced up, surprised.
Why not? It's your last name, isn't it?
The image of Simon rose up behind her eyes. Simon, the last time she had seen him, staring after her, she ran out of Java Jones. She turned back to the poster, blinking.
No reason. I see, Jay said, and she could tell from his voice that he did see, more than she wanted him to.
She heard him drop the book back onto the shelf.
This must be the trash she keeps up front to impress credible mundanes, he said, sounding disgusted. There's not one serious text here.
Just because it's not the kind of magic you do, Clary began crossly.
He scowled furiously, silencing her. I do not do magic, he said. Get it through your head. Human beings are not magic users. It's part of what makes them human. Witches and warlocks can only use magic because they have demon blood.
Clary took a moment to process this.
But I've seen you use magic. You use enchanted weapons.
I use tools that are magical. And just to be able to do that, I have to undergo rigorous training. The rune tattoos on my skin protect me, too. If you tried to use one of the seraph blades, for instance, it'd probably burn your skin, maybe kill you.
What if I got the tattoos? Clary asked. Could I use them then?
No, Jace said crossly. The marks are only part of it. There are tests, ordeals, levels of training. Look, just forget it, okay? Stay away from my blades. In fact, don't touch any of my weapons without my permission. Well, there goes my plan for selling them all on eBay, Clary muttered. Selling them on what? Clary smiled blandly at him. A mythical place of great magical power. Jace looked confused, then shrugged. Most myths are true, at least in part. I'm starting to get that. The bead curtain rattled again, and Madame Dorothea's head appeared. Tea's on the table, she said. There's no need for you two to keep standing there like donkeys. Come into the parlor.
There's a parlor? Clary said.
Of course there's a parlor, said Dorothea. Where else would I entertain? I'll just leave my hat with the footman, said Jace. Madame Dorothea shot him a dark look. If you were half as funny as you thought you were, my boy, you'd be twice as funny as you are. She disappeared back through the curtain, her loud humph nearly drowned out by rattling beads. Jace frowned. I'm not quite sure what she meant by that.
Really? Said Clary. Made perfect sense to me.
She marched through the bead curtain before he could reply. The parlor was so dimly lit that it took several blinks for Clary's eyes to adjust. Faint light outlined the black velvet curtains drawn across the entire left wall. Stuffed birds and bats dangled from the ceiling on thin cords, shiny dark beads where their eyes should have been. The floor was layered with frayed Persian rugs that spat up puffs of dust underfoot. A group of overstuffed pink armchairs were gathered around a low table. A stack of tarot cards bound with a silk ribbon occupied one end of the table, a crystal ball and a gold stand the other. In the middle of the table was a silver tea service laid out for company, a neat plate of stacked sandwiches, a blue teapot unfurling a thin stream of white smoke, and two teacups on matching saucers set carefully in front of two of the armchairs.
Wow, Clary said weakly. This looks great.
She took a seat in one of the armchairs. It felt good to sit down. Dorothea smiled, her eyes glinting with a sly humor.
Have some tea, she said, hefting the pot. Milk? Sugar?
Clary looked sideways at Jace, who was sitting beside her and who had taken possession of the sandwich plate. He was examining it closely.
Sugar, she said.
Jace shrugged, took a sandwich, and set the plate down. Clary watched him warily as he bit into it. He shrugged again. Cucumber, he said in response to her stare.
I always think cucumber sandwiches are just the thing for tea, don't you?
Madame Dorothea inquired of no one in particular. I hate cucumber, Jace said and handed the rest of his sandwich to Clary. She bit into it. It was seasoned with just the right amount of mayonnaise and pepper. Her stomach rumbled in grateful appreciation of the first food she'd tasted since the nachos she'd eaten with Simon.
Cucumber and bergamot, Clary said.
Is there anything else you hate that I ought to know about? Jace looked at Dorothea over the rim of his teacup. Liars, he said. Calmly, the old woman set her teapot down.
You can call me a liar all you like. It's true. I'm not a witch, but my mother was.
Jace choked on his tea. That's impossible.
Why impossible? Clary asked curiously.
She took a sip of her tea. It was bitter, strongly flavored with a peaty smokiness. Jace expelled a breath.
Because they're half-human, half-demon. All witches and warlocks are crossbreeds. And because they're crossbreeds, they can't have children. They're sterile.
Like mules, Clary said thoughtfully, remembering something from biology class.
Mules are sterile crossbreeds.
Your knowledge of livestock is astounding, said Jace. All downworlders are in some part demon, but only warlocks are the children of demon parents. It's why their powers are the strongest.
Vampires and werewolves, they're part demon too? And fairies?
Vampires and werewolves are the result of diseases brought by demons from their home dimensions. Most demon diseases are deadly to humans, but in these cases, they worked strange changes on the infected without actually killing them. And fairies are fallen angels, said Dorothea, cast down out of heaven for their pride. That's the legend, Jace said. It's also said that they're the offspring of demons and angels, which always seem more likely to me. good and evil mixing together. Fairies are as beautiful as angels are supposed to be, but they have a lot of mischief and cruelty in them, and you'll notice most of them avoid midday sunlight. "For the devil has no power," said Dorothea softly, as if she were reciting an old rhyme, "except in the dark." Jace scowled at her. Clary said, "Supposed to be? You mean angels don't..."
"Enough about angels," said Dorothea, suddenly practical. "It's true that warlocks can't have children. My mother adopted me because she wanted to make sure there'd be someone to attend this place after she was gone. I don't have to master magic myself. I have only to watch and guard."
"Guard what?" asked Clary.
"What indeed?"
With a wink, the older woman reached for a sandwich from the plate, but it was empty. Clary had eaten them all. Dorothea chuckled.
"It's good to see a young woman eat her fill. In my day, girls were robust, strapping creatures, not twigs like they are nowadays."
"Thanks," Clary said. She thought of Isabel's tiny waist and suddenly felt gigantic. She set her empty teacup down with a clatter. Instantly, Madame Dorothea pounced on the cup and stared into it intently, a line appearing between her penciled eyebrows. "What?" Clary said nervously. "Did I crack the cup or something?"
"She's reading your tea leaves," Jace said, sounding bored. But he leaned forward along with Clary as Dorothea turned the cup around and around in her thick fingers, scowling.
"Is it bad?" Clary asked.
"It's neither bad nor good. It's confusing."
Dorothea looked at Jace.
"Give me your cup," she commanded.
Jace looked affronted. "But I'm not done with my..." The old woman snatched the cup out of his hand and splashed the excess tea back into the pot. Frowning, she gazed at what remained.
"I see violence in your future. A great deal of bloodshed by you and others. You'll fall in love with the wrong person. Also, you have an enemy."
"Only one, that's good news."
Jace leaned back in his chair as Dorothea put down his cup and picked up Clary's again. She shook her head.
"There's nothing for me to read here. These images are jumbled, meaningless."
She glanced at Clary.
"Is there a block in your mind?"
Clary was puzzled. "A what?"
"Like a spell that might conceal a memory or might have blocked out your sight?"
Clary shook her head. "No, of course not." Jace leaned forward alertly. "Don't be so hasty," he said. "It's true that she claims not to remember ever having had the sight before this week. Maybe I'm just a late developer," Clary snapped.
"And don't leer at me just because I said that."
Jace assumed an injured air.
"I wasn't going to."
"You were going to work up to a leer, I could tell."
"Maybe," Jace acknowledged.
"But that doesn't mean I'm not right. Something's blocking your memories, I'm almost sure of it."
"Very well, let's try something else."
Dorothea put the cup down and reached for the silk-wrapped tarot cards. She fanned the cards and held them out to Clary.
"Slide your hand over these until you touch one that feels hot or cold or seems to cling to your fingers. Then draw that one and show it to me."
Obediently, Clary ran her fingers over the cards. They felt cool to the touch and slippery, but none seemed particularly warm or cold, and none stuck to her fingers. Finally, she selected one at random and held it up.
"The Ace of Cups," Dorothea said, sounding bemused. "The Love Card."
Clary turned it over and looked at it. The card was heavy in her hand, the image on the front thick with real paint. It showed a hand holding up a cup in front of a rayed sun painted with gilt. The cup was made of gold, engraved with a pattern of smaller suns and studded with rubies. The style of the artwork was as familiar to her as her own breath.
"This is a good card, right?"
"Not necessarily. The most terrible things men do, they do in the name of love," said Madame Dorothea, her eyes gleaming. "But it is a powerful card. What does it mean to you?"
"That my mother painted it," said Clary, and dropped the card onto the table.
"She did, didn't she?" Dorothea nodded, a look of pleased satisfaction on her face.
"She painted the whole pack. A gift for me."
"So you say." Jace stood up, his eyes cold.
How well did you know Clary's mother?
Clary craned her head to look up at him. Jace, you don't have to...
Dorothea sat back in her chair, the cards fanned out across her wide chest.
Jocelyn knew what I was, and I knew what she was. We didn't talk about it much. Sometimes she did favors for me, like painting this pack of cards, and in return, I'd tell her the occasional piece of downworld gossip. There was a name she asked me to keep an ear out for, and I did.
Jace's expression was unreadable.
What name was that?
Valentine.
Clary sat straight up in her chair.
But that's...
And when you say you knew what Jocelyn was, what do you mean? What was she? Jace asked.
Jocelyn was what she was, said Dorothea. But in her past, she'd been like you.
A shadow hunter. One of the Clave.
No, Clary whispered.
Dorothea looked at her with sad, almost kindly eyes.
It's true. She chose to live in this house precisely because this is a sanctuary, Jace said to Dorothea.
Isn't it?
Your mother was a control. She made this space hidden, protected. It's a perfect spot for downworlders on the run to hide out. That's what you do, isn't it? You hide criminals here.
You would call them that, Dorothea said. You're familiar with the motto of the Covenant?
Sed lex dura lex, said Jace automatically. The law is hard, but it is the law.
Sometimes the law is too hard. I know the Clave would have taken me away from my mother if they could. You want me to let them do the same to others?
So you're a philanthropist? Jace's lip curled. I suppose you expect me to believe that downworlders don't pay you handsomely for the privilege of your sanctuary?
Dorothea grinned, wide enough to show a flash of gold molars.
We can't all get by on our looks like you.
Jace looked unmoved by the flattery. I should tell the Clave about you.
You can't! Clary was on her feet now. You promised!
I never promised anything.
Jace looked mutinous. He strode to the wall and tore aside one of the velvet hangings.
You want to tell me what this is? He demanded.
It's a door, Jace, said Clary.
It was a door, set strangely in the wall between the two bay windows. Clearly, it couldn't be a door that led anywhere or would have been visible from the outside of the house. It looked as if it were made of some softly glowing metal, more buttery than brass, but as heavy as iron. The knob had been cast in the shape of an eye.
Shut up, Jay said angrily. It's a portal, isn't it?
It's a five-dimensional door, said Dorothea, laying the tarot cards back on the table. Dimensions aren't all straight lines, you know, she added in response to Clary's blank look. There are dips and folds and nooks and crannies all tucked away. It's a bit hard to explain when you've never studied dimensional theory, but in essence, that door can take you anywhere in this dimension that you want to go.
It's an escape hatch, Jace said. That's why your mother wanted to live here, so she could always flee at a moment's notice.
Then why didn't she? Clary began and broke off, suddenly horrified.
Because of me, she said. She wouldn't leave without me that night, so she stayed.
Jace was shaking his head. You can't blame yourself. Feeling tears gather under her eyelids, Clary pushed past Jace to the door.
I want to see where she would have gone, she said, reaching for the door. I want to see where she was going to escape to.
Clary, no!
Jace reached for her, but her fingers had already closed around the knob. It spun rapidly under her hand, the door flying open as if she'd pushed it. Dorothea lumbered to her feet with a cry, but it was too late. Before she could even finish her sentence, Clary found herself flung forward and tumbling through empty space. 8. Weapon of Choice. She was too surprised to scream. The sensation of falling was the worst part. Her heart flew up into her throat and her stomach turned to water. She flung her hands out, trying to catch at something, anything that might slow her descent. Her hands closed on branches. Leaves tore off in her grip. She thumped to the ground hard, her hip and her shoulder striking packed earth.
She rolled over, sucking the air back into her lungs. She was just beginning to sit up when someone landed on top of her. She was knocked backward. A forehead banged against hers, her knees banging against someone else's. Tangled up in arms and legs, Clary coughed hair, not her own, out of her mouth and tried to struggle out from under the weight that felt like it was crushing her flat. "Ouch," Jace said in her ear, his tone indignant. "You elbowed me. Well, you landed on me." He levered himself up on his arms and looked down at her placidly. Clary could see blue sky above his head, a bit of a tree branch, and the corner of a gray clapboard house. "Well, you didn't leave me much choice, did you?" he asked. "Not after you decided to leap merrily through that portal like you were jumping the F train. You're just lucky it didn't dump us out in the East River." "You didn't have to come after me." "Yes, I did," he said. "You're far too inexperienced to protect yourself in a hostile situation without me." "That's sweet. Maybe I'll forgive you." "Forgive me for what? For telling me to shut up?" His eyes narrowed. "I did not. Well, I did, but you were..." "Never mind." Her arm, pinned under her back, was beginning to cramp. Rolling to the side to free it, she saw the brown grass of a dead lawn, a chain-link fence, and more of the gray clapboard house, now distressingly familiar. She froze. "I know where we are." Jace stopped, spluttering. "What? This is Luke's house." She sat up, pitching Jace to the side. He rolled gracefully to his feet and held out a hand to help her up. She ignored him and scrambled upright, shaking out her numb arm. They stood in front of a small gray row house nestled among the other row houses that lined the Williamsburg waterfront. A breeze blew off the East River, setting a small sign swinging over the brick front steps. Clary watched Jace as he read the block-lettered words aloud. "Garraway Books. Fine, used, new, and out of print. Closed Saturdays." He glanced at the dark front door, its knob wound with a heavy padlock. A few days' worth of mail lay on the doormat untouched. He glanced at Clary. "He lives in a bookstore?" "He lives behind the store." Clary glanced up and down the empty street, which was bordered on one end by the arched span of the Williamsburg Bridge and by a deserted sugar factory on the other. Across the sluggishly moving river, the sun was setting behind the skyscrapers of Lower Manhattan, outlining them in gold. "Jace, how did we get here?" "Through the portal," Jace said, examining the padlock. "It takes you to whatever place you're thinking of." "But I wasn't thinking of here," Clary objected. I wasn't thinking of anywhere." "You must have been." He dropped the subject, seeming uninterested. "So, since we're here anyway..." "Yeah? What do you want to do?" "Leave, I guess," Clary said bitterly. "Luke told me not to come here." Jace shook his head. "And you just accept that?" Clary hugged her arms around herself. Despite the fading heat of the day, she felt cold. "Do I have a choice?" "We always have choices," Jace said. "If I were you, I'd be pretty curious about Luke right now. Do you have the keys to the house?" Clary shook her head. "No, but sometimes he leaves the back door unlocked." She pointed to the narrow alley between Luke's row house and the next. Plastic trash cans were propped in a neat row beside stacks of folded newspapers and a plastic tub of empty soda bottles. At least Luke was still a responsible recycler. "You sure he isn't home?" Jace asked. She glanced at the empty curb. "Well, his truck's gone, the store's closed, and all the lights are off. I'd say probably not." "Then lead the way." The narrow aisle between the row houses ended in a high chain-link fence. It surrounded Luke's small back garden, where the only plants flourishing seemed to be the weeds that had sprung up through the paving stones, cracking them into powdery shards. "Up and over," Jay said, jamming the toe of a boot into a gap in the fence. He began to climb. The fence rattled so loudly that Clary glanced around nervously, but there were no lights on in the neighbor's house. Jace cleared the top of the fence and sprang down the other side, landing in the bushes to the accompaniment of an ear-splitting yowl.
For a moment, Clary thought he must have landed on a stray cat. She heard Jace shout in surprise as he fell backward. A dark shadow, much too big to be a feline, exploded out of the shrubbery and streaked across the yard, keeping low. Rolling to his feet, Jace darted after it, looking murderous. Clary started to climb. As she threw her leg over the top of the fence, Isabel's jeans caught on a twist of wire and tore up the side. She dropped to the ground, shoes scuffing the soft dirt just as Jace cried out in triumph. Got him! Clary turned to see Jace sitting on top of the prone intruder whose arms were up over his head. Jace grabbed for his wrist. Come on, let's see your face! Get the hell off of me, you pretentious asshole! The intruder snarled, shoving at Jace. He struggled halfway into a sitting position, his battered glasses knocked askew. Clary stopped dead in her tracks. Simon? Oh, God, said Jace, sounding resigned. And here I'd actually hoped I'd got hold of something interesting. But what are you doing hiding in Luke's bushes? Clary asked, brushing leaves out of Simon's hair. He suffered her ministrations with glaring bad grace. Somehow, when she'd pictured her reunion with Simon when all this was over, he'd been in a better mood. That's the part I don't get. All right, that's enough. I can fix my own hair, Frey, Simon said, jerking away from her touch. They were sitting on the steps of Luke's back porch. Jace had propped himself on the porch railing and was assiduously pretending to ignore them while using the stele to file the edges of his fingernails. Clary wondered if the clave would approve. I mean, did Luke know you were there? She asked. Of course he didn't know I was there, Simon said irritably. I've never asked him, but I'm sure he has a fairly stringent policy about random teenagers lurking in his shrubbery. You're not random, he knows you. She wanted to reach out and touch his cheek, still bleeding slightly where a branch had scratched it. The main thing is that you're all right. That I'm all right? Simon laughed, a sharp, unhappy sound. Clary, do you have any idea what I've been through this past couple days? The last time I saw you, you were running out of Java Jones like a bat out of hell, and then you just disappeared. You never picked up your cell, then your home phone was disconnected, then Luke told me you were off staying with some relatives upstate when I know you don't have any other relatives. I thought I'd done something to piss you off. What could you possibly have done? Clary reached for his hand, but he pulled it back without looking at her. I don't know, he said. Something. Jace, still occupied with the stele, chuckled low under his breath. You're my best friend, Clary said. I wasn't mad at you. Yeah, well, you clearly also couldn't be bothered to call me and tell me you were shacking up with some dyed blonde wannabe goth you probably met at Pandemonium, Simon pointed out sourly. After I spent the past 3 days wondering if you were dead. I was not shacking up, Clary said, glad of the darkness as the blood rushed to her face. And my hair is naturally blonde, said Jace, just for the record. So what have you been doing these past 3 days, then? Simon said, his eyes dark with suspicion. Do you really have a great Aunt Matilda who contracted avian flu and needed to be nursed back to health? Did Luke actually say that? No, he just said you'd gone to visit a sick relative and that your phone probably just didn't work out in the country, not that I believed him. After he shooed me off his front porch, I went around the side of the house and looked in the back window. Watched him packing up a green duffel bag like he was going away for the weekend. That was when I decided to stick around and keep an eye on things. Why? Because he was packing a bag? He was packing it full of weapons, Simon said, scrubbing the blood on his cheek with the sleeve of his t-shirt. Knives, a couple of daggers, even a sword. Funny thing is, some of the weapons looked like they were glowing. He looked from Clary to Jace and back again. His tone was edged as sharply as one of Luke's knives. Now are you going to say I was imagining it? No, Clary said, I am not going to say that. She glanced at Jace. The last light of sunset struck gold sparks from his eyes. She said, I'm going to tell him the truth. I know.
Are you going to try to stop me?
He looked down at the stele in his hand. My oath to the covenant binds me, he said. No such oath binds you.
She turned back to Simon, taking a deep breath.
All right, she said. Here's what you have to know.
The sun had slipped entirely past the horizon, and the porch was in darkness by the time Clary stopped speaking. Simon had listened to her lengthy explanation with a nearly impassive expression, only wincing a little when she got to the part about the Ravener demon. When she was done speaking, she cleared her dry throat, suddenly dying for a glass of water.
So, she said, any questions?
Simon held up his hand.
Oh, I've got questions. Several.
Clary exhaled warily.
Okay, shoot.
He pointed at Jace.
Now, he's a... What do you call people like him again?
He's a shadow hunter, Clary said.
A demon hunter, Jace clarified. I kill demons. It's not that complicated, really.
Simon looked at Clary again.
For real?
His eyes were narrowed as if he half expected her to tell him that none of this was true and Jace was actually a dangerous escaped lunatic she decided to befriend on humanitarian grounds.
For real. There was an intent look on Simon's face.
And there are vampires, too?
Werewolves, warlocks, all that stuff?
Clary gnawed her lower lip.
So I hear.
And you kill them, too? Simon asked, directing the question to Jace, who had put the stele back in his pocket and was examining his flawless nails for defects.
Only when they've been naughty.
For a moment, Simon merely sat and stared down at his feet. Clary wondered if burdening him with this kind of information had been the wrong thing to do. He had a stronger practical streak than almost anyone else she knew. He might hate knowing something like this, something for which there was no logical explanation. She leaned forward anxiously just as Simon lifted his head.
That is so awesome, he said.
Jace looked as startled as Clary felt.
Awesome?
Simon nodded enthusiastically enough to make the dark curls bounce on his forehead.
Totally. It's like Dungeons and Dragons, but real.
Jace was looking at Simon as if he were some bizarre species of insect.
It's like what?
It's a game, Clary explained. She felt vaguely embarrassed. People pretend to be wizards and elves and they kill monsters and stuff. Jace looked stupefied. Simon grinned.
You've never heard of Dungeons and Dragons?
I've heard of dungeons, Jace said. Also dragons, although they're mostly extinct. Simon looked disappointed.
You've never killed a dragon?
He's probably never met a 6-foot-tall, hot elf woman in a fur bikini either, Clary said irritably. Lay off, Simon.
Real elves are about 8 inches tall, Jace pointed out. Also, they bite.
But vampires are hot, right? Simon said. I mean, some of the vampires are babes, aren't they?
Clary worried for a moment that Jace might lunge across the porch and throttle Simon senseless. Instead, he considered the question.
Some of them, maybe.
Awesome, Simon repeated.
Clary decided she had preferred it when they were fighting. Jace slid off the porch railing.
So, are we going to go search the house or not?
Simon scrambled to his feet. I'm game. What are we looking for?
We, said Jace with a sinister delicacy. I don't remember inviting you along.
Jace! Clary said angrily. The left corner of his mouth curled up.
Just joking.
He stepped aside to leave her a clear path to the door.
Shall we?
Clary fumbled for the doorknob in the dark. It opened, triggering the porch light which illuminated the entryway. The door that led into the bookstore was closed. Clary jiggled the knob. It's locked.
Allow me, mundanes, said Jace, setting her gently aside.
He took his stele out of his pocket and put it to the door. Simon watched him with some resentment. No amount of vampire babes, Clary suspected, was ever going to make him like Jace.
He's a piece of work, isn't he? Simon muttered.
How do you stand him? He saved my life. Simon glanced at her quickly.
How?
With a click, the door swung open. Here we go, said Jace, sliding his stele back into his pocket. Clary saw the mark on the door, just over his head, fade as they passed through it. The back door opened onto a small storage room, the bare walls peeling paint. Cardboard boxes were stacked everywhere, their contents identified with marker scrawls. Fiction, poetry, cooking, local interest, romance. The apartment's through here. Clary headed toward the door she'd indicated at the far end of the room. Jace caught her arm. Wait. She looked at him nervously. Is something wrong? I don't know. He edged between two narrow stacks of boxes and whistled. Clary, you might want to come over here and see this. She glanced around. It was dim in the storage room, the only illumination the porch light shining through the window. It's so dark. Light flared up, bathing the room in a brilliant glow. Simon turned his head aside, blinking. Ouch. Jace chuckled. He was standing on top of a sealed box, his hand raised. Something glowed in his palm, the light escaping through his cupped fingers. Which light? He said. Simon muttered something under his breath. Clary was already clambering through the boxes, pushing away to Jace. He was standing behind a teetering pile of mysteries, the witch light casting an eerie glow over his face. Look at that, he said, indicating a space higher up on the wall. At first she thought he was pointing at what looked like a pair of ornamental sconces. As her eyes adjusted, she realized they were actually loops of metal attached to short chains, the ends of which were sunk into the wall. Are those... manacles? Said Simon, picking his way through the boxes. That's, don't say kinky. Clary shot him a warning look. This is Luke we're talking about. Jace reached up to run his hand along the inside of one of the metal loops. When he lowered it, his fingers were dusted with red-brown powder. Blood. And look. He pointed to the wall right around where the chains were sunk in. The plaster seemed to bulge outward. Someone tried to yank these things out of the wall, tried pretty hard from the looks of it. Clary's heart had begun to beat hard inside her chest. Do you think Luke is all right? Jace lowered the witch light. I think we better find out.
This ends Disc 3. City of Bones, Disc 4.
The door to the apartment was unlocked. It led into Luke's living room. Despite the hundreds of books in the store itself, there were hundreds more in the apartment. Bookshelves rose to the ceiling, the volumes on them double-parked, one row blocking another. Most were poetry and fiction, with plenty of fantasy and mystery thrown in. Clary remembered plowing through the entirety of the Chronicles of Prydain here, curled up in Luke's window seat as the sun went down over the East River. I think he's still around, called Simon, standing in the doorway of Luke's small kitchenette. The percolator's on and there's coffee here, still hot. Clary peered around the kitchen door. Dishes were stacked in the sink. Luke's jackets were hung neatly on hooks inside the coat closet. She walked down the hallway and opened the door of his small bedroom. It looked the same as ever, the bed with its gray coverlid and flat pillows unmade, the top of the bureau covered in loose change. She turned away. Some part of her had been absolutely certain that when they walked in, they'd find the place torn to pieces and Luke tied up, injured or worse. Now she didn't know what to think. Numbly, she crossed the hall to the little guest bedroom where she'd so often stayed when her mother was out of town on business. They'd stay up late, watching old horror movies on the flickering black and white TV. She even kept a backpack full of extra things here so she didn't have to lug her stuff back and forth from home. Kneeling down, she tugged it out from under the bed by its olive-green strap. It was covered with buttons, most of which Simon had given her. Gamers do it better. Otaku wench, still not king. Inside were some folded clothes, a few spare pairs of underwear, a hairbrush, even shampoo. Thank God, she thought, and kicked the bedroom door closed. Quickly she changed, stripping off Isabel's too big and now grass-stained and sweaty clothes, and pulling on a pair of her own sandblasted cords, soft as worn paper, and a blue tank top with a design of Chinese characters across the front. She tossed Isabel's clothes into her backpack, yanked the cord shut, and left the bedroom, the pack bouncing familiarly between her shoulder blades. It was nice to have something of her own again. She found Jace in Luke's book-lined office examining a green duffel bag that lay unzipped across the desk. It was, as Simon had said, full of weapons. Sheathed knives, a coiled whip, and something that looked like a razor-edged metal disc. "It's a chakram," said Jace, looking up as Clary came into the room. "A Sikh weapon. You whirl it around your index finger before releasing it. They're rare and hard to use. Strange that Luke would have one. They used to be Hodge's weapon of choice back in the day, or so he tells me." "Luke collects stuff. Art objects, you know," Clary said, indicating the shelf behind the desk, which was lined with bronze Indian and Russian idols. Her favorite was a statuette of the Indian goddess of destruction, Kali, brandishing a sword and a severed head as she danced with her head thrown back and her eyes slitted closed. To the side of the desk was an antique Chinese screen carved out of glowing rosewood. "Pretty things." Jace moved the chakram aside gingerly. A handful of clothes spilled out of the untied end of Luke's duffel bag as if they had been an afterthought. "I think this is yours, by the way." He drew out a rectangular object hidden among the clothes. A wooden framed photograph with a long vertical crack along the glass. The crack threw a network of spidery lines across the smiling faces of Clary, Luke, and her mother. "That is mine," Clary said, taking it out of his hand. "It's cracked," Jace observed. "I know. I did that. I smashed it when I threw it at the Ravener demon." She looked at him, seeing the dawning realization on his face. "That means Luke's been back to the apartment since the attack, maybe even today." "He must have been the last person to come through the portal," said Jace. "That's why it took us here. You weren't thinking of anything, so it sent us to the last place it had been." "Nice of Dorothea to tell us he was there," said Clary. "He probably paid her off to be quiet. Either that or she trusts him more than she trusts us, which means he might not be—" "Guys!" It was Simon, dashing into the office in a panic. "Someone's coming!" Clary dropped the photo. "Is it Luke?" Simon peered back down the hall, then nodded. "It is, but he's not by himself. There are two men with him." "Men?" Jace crossed the room in a few strides, peered through the door, and spat a curse under his breath. "Warlocks." Clary stared. "Warlocks?" But shaking his head, Jace backed away from the door. "Is there some other way out of here? A back door?" Clary shook her head. The sound of footsteps in the hallway was audible now, striking pangs of fear into her chest. Jace looked around desperately. His eyes came to rest on the rosewood screen. "Get behind that," he said, pointing. "Now." Clary dropped the fractured photo on the desk and slipped behind the screen, pulling Simon after her. Jace was right behind them, his stele in his hand. He had barely concealed himself when Clary heard the door swing wide open, the sound of people walking into Luke's office, then voices. Three men speaking. She looked nervously at Simon, who was very pale, and then at Jace, who had raised the stele in his hand and was moving the tip lightly, in a sort of square shape across the back of the screen. As Clary stared, the square went clear, like a pane of glass. She heard Simon suck in his breath, a tiny sound, barely audible, and Jace shook his head at both of them, mouthing words. "They can't see us through it, but we can see them." Biting her lip, Clary moved to the edge of the square and peered through it, conscious of Simon breathing down her neck. She could see the room beyond perfectly. The bookshelves, the desk with the duffel bag thrown across it. And Luke, ragged-looking and slightly stooped, his glasses pushed up to the top of his head, standing near the door. It was frightening, even though she knew he couldn't see her, that the window Jace had made was like the glass in a police station interrogation room, strictly one way. Luke turned, looking back through the doorway. "Yes, feel free to look around," he said, his tone heavily weighted with sarcasm. "Nice of you to show such an interest." A low chuckle sounded from the corner of the office. With an impatient flick of the wrist,
Jace tapped the frame of his window, and it opened out wider, showing more of the room. There were two men there with Luke, both in long reddish robes, their hoods pushed back. One was thin, with an elegant gray mustache and pointed beard. When he smiled, he showed blindingly white teeth. The other was burly, thick-set as a wrestler, with close-cropped reddish hair. His skin was dark purple and looked shiny over the cheekbones as if it had been stretched too tight.
"Those are warlocks," Clary whispered softly.
Jace didn't answer. He had gone rigid all over, stiff as a bar of iron.
"He's afraid I'll make a run for it, try to get to Luke," Clary thought.
She wished she could reassure him that she wouldn't. There was something about those two men in their thick cloaks, the color of arterial blood, that was terrifying.
"Consider this a friendly follow-up, Greymark," said the man with the gray mustache.
His smile showed teeth so sharp they looked as if they'd been filed to cannibal points.
"There's nothing friendly about you, Pangborn."
Luke sat down on the edge of his desk, angling his body so it blocked the men's view of his duffel bag and its contents. Now that he was closer, Clary could see that his face and hands were badly bruised, his fingers scraped and bloody. A long cut along his neck disappeared down into his collar.
What on earth happened to him?
"Blackwell, don't touch that. It's valuable," Luke said sternly.
The big red-headed man who had picked up the statue of Kali from the top of the bookcase ran his beefy fingers over it consideringly.
"Nice," he said.
"Ah,"
said Pangborn, taking the statue from his companion.
"She who was created to battle a demon who could not be killed by any god or man. Oh, Kali, my mother full of bliss, enchantress of the almighty Shiva, in thy delirious joy thou dancest, clapping thy hands together. Thou art the mover of all that moves, and we are but thy helpless toys."
"Very nice," said Luke. "I didn't know you were a student of the Indian myths."
"All the myths are true,"
said Pangborn, and Clary felt a small shiver go up her spine.
"Or have you forgotten even that?"
"I forget nothing," said Luke. Though he looked relaxed, Clary could see tension in the lines of his shoulders and mouth.
"I suppose Valentine sent you?"
"He did," said Pangborn.
"He thought you might have changed your mind."
"There's nothing to change my mind about. I already told you I don't know anything. Nice cloaks, by the way."
"Thanks," said Blackwell with a sly grin. "Skin them off a couple of dead warlocks."
"Those are official Accord robes, aren't they?" Luke asked. "Are they from the Uprising?" Pangborn chuckled softly.
"Spoils of battle."
"Aren't you afraid someone might mistake you for the real thing?"
"Not," said Blackwell, "once they got up close."
Pangborn fondled the edge of his robe.
"Do you remember the Uprising, Lucian?" he said softly. "That was a great and terrible day. Do you remember how we trained together for the battle?"
Luke's face twisted. "The past is the past. I don't know what to tell you, gentlemen. I can't help you now. I don't know anything."
"Anything is such a general word, so unspecific," said Pangborn, sounding melancholy. "Surely someone who owns so many books must know something."
"If you want to know where to find a jog-toed swallow in springtime, I could direct you to the correct reference title. But if you want to know where the mortal cup has disappeared to..."
"Disappeared might not be quite the correct word," purred Pangborn. "Hidden, more like. Hidden by Jocelyn."
"That may be," said Luke. "So hasn't she told you where it is yet?"
"She has not yet regained consciousness," said Pangborn, carving the air with a long-fingered hand. "Valentine is disappointed. He was looking forward to their reunion."
"I'm sure she didn't reciprocate the sentiment," muttered Luke. Pangborn cackled.
"Jealous, Greymark? Perhaps you no longer feel about her the way you used to."
A trembling had started in Clary's fingers, so pronounced that she knitted her hands together tightly to try to stop them from shaking.
"Jocelyn, can they be talking about my mother?"
"I never felt any way about her particularly," said Luke.
Two shadow hunters exiled from their own kind. You can see why we might have banded together. But I'm not going to try to interfere with Valentine's plans for her if that's what he's worried about.
I wouldn't say he was worried, said Pangborn. More curious. We all wondered if you were still alive, still recognizably human.
Luke arched his eyebrows.
And?
You seem well enough, said Pangborn grudgingly. He set the Kali statue down on the shelf.
There was a child, wasn't there? A girl?
Luke looked taken aback. What?
Don't play dumb, said Blackwell in his snarl of a voice. We know the bitch had a daughter. They found photos of her in the apartment. A bedroom.
I thought you were asking about children of mine, Luke interrupted smoothly. Yes, Jocelyn had a daughter. Clarissa. I assume she's run off. Did Valentine send you to find her?
Not us, said Pangborn. But he is looking. We could search this place, added Blackwell.
I wouldn't advise it, said Luke and slid off the desk. There was a certain cold menace to his look as he stared down at the two men, though his expression hadn't changed.
What makes you think she's still alive?
I thought Valentine sent raveners to scour the place. Enough ravener poison and most people will crumble away to ashes, leave no trace behind.
There was a dead ravener, said Pangborn. It made Valentine suspicious.
Everything makes Valentine suspicious, said Luke.
Maybe Jocelyn killed it. She was certainly capable.
Blackwell grunted.
Maybe.
Luke shrugged. Look, I've got no idea where the girl is, but for what it's worth, I'd guess she's dead. She'd have turned up by now otherwise. Anyway, she's not much of a danger. She's 15 years old. She's never heard of Valentine, and she doesn't believe in demons.
Pangborn chuckled. A fortunate child.
Not anymore, said Luke. Blackwell raised his eyebrows.
You sound angry, Lucian.
I'm not angry, I'm exasperated. I'm not planning on interfering with Valentine's plans. Do you understand that? I'm not a fool.
Really, said Blackwell. It's nice to see that you've developed a healthy respect for your own skin over the years, Lucian. You weren't always so pragmatic.
You do know, said Pangborn, his tone conversational, that we'd trade her, Jocelyn, for the cup, safely delivered right to your door. That's a promise from Valentine himself. I know, said Luke. I'm not interested. I don't know where your precious cup is, and I don't want to get involved in your politics. I hate Valentine. He added, but I respect him. I know he'll mow down everyone in his path. I intend to be out of his way when it happens. He's a monster. A killing machine.
Look who's talking, snarled Blackwell.
I take it these are your preparations for removing yourself from Valentine's path, said Pangborn, pointing a long finger at the half-concealed duffel bag on the desk.
Getting out of town, Lucian?
Luke nodded slowly. Going to the country. I plan to lay low for a while.
We could stop you, said Blackwell. Make you stay.
Luke smiled. It transformed his face. Suddenly, he was no longer the kind, scholarly man who'd pushed Clary on the swings at the park and taught her how to ride a tricycle. Suddenly, there was something feral behind his eyes, something vicious and cold.
You could try.
Pangborn glanced at Blackwell, who shook his head once, slowly. Pangborn turned back to Luke.
You'll notify us if you experience any sudden memory resurgence.
Luke was still smiling.
You'll be first on my list to call.
Pangborn nodded shortly. I suppose we'll take our leave. The angel guard you, Lucian.
The angel does not guard those like me, said Luke.
He picked the duffel bag up off the desk and nodded the top. On your way, gentlemen. Lifting their hoods to cover their faces again, the two men left the room, followed a moment later by Luke. He paused a moment at the door, glancing around as if he wondered if he'd forgotten something. Then he shut it carefully behind him. Clary stayed where she was, frozen, hearing the front door swing shut and the distant jingle of chain and keys as Luke refastened the padlock. She kept seeing the look on Luke's face over and over as he said he wasn't interested in what happened to her mother. She felt a hand on her shoulder. Clary? It was Simon, his voice hesitant, almost gentle. Are you okay? She shook her head mutely. She felt far from okay. In fact, she felt like she'd never be okay again. Of course she isn't. It was Jace, his voice sharp and cold as ice shards. He took hold of the screen and moved it aside sharply. At least now we know who would send a demon after your mother. Those men think she has the mortal cup. Clary felt her lips thin into a straight line. That's totally ridiculous and impossible. Maybe, said Jace, leaning against Luke's desk. He fixed her with eyes as opaque as smoked glass. Have you ever seen those men before? No, she shook her head, never. Lucian seemed to know them, to be friendly with them. I wouldn't say friendly, said Simon. I'd say they were suppressing their hostility. They didn't kill him outright, said Jace. They think he knows more than he's telling. Maybe, said Clary, or maybe they're just reluctant to kill another Shadow Hunter. Jace laughed, a harsh, almost vicious noise that raised the hairs up on Clary's arms. I doubt that. She looked at him hard. What makes you so sure? Do you know them? The laughter had gone from his voice entirely when he replied. Do I know them? He echoed. You might say that. Those are the men who murdered my father. 9. The Circle and the Brotherhood. Clary stepped forward to touch Jace's arm, say something, anything. What did you say to someone who'd just seen his father's killers? Her hesitation turned out not to matter. Jace shrugged her touch off as if it stung. We should go, he said, stalking out of the office and into the living room. Clary and Simon hurried after him. We don't know when Luke might come back. They left through the back entrance, Jace using his stele to lock up behind them, and made their way out onto the silent street. The moon hung like a locket over the city, casting pearly reflections on the water of the East River. The distant hum of cars going by over the Williamsburg Bridge filled the humid air with a sound like beating wings. Simon said, "Does anyone want to tell me where we're going?" "To the L train," said Jace calmly. "You've got to be kidding me," Simon said, blinking. "Demon slayers take the subway? It's faster than driving." I thought it'd be something cooler, like a van with death to demons painted on the outside, or... Jace didn't even bother to interrupt. Clary shot Jace a sideways look. Sometimes when Jocelyn was really angry about something or was in one of her upset moods, she would get what Clary called scary calm. It was a calm that made Clary think of the deceptive, hard sheen of ice just before it cracked under your weight. Jace was scary calm. His face was expressionless, but something burned at the backs of his tawny eyes. Simon, she said, enough. Simon shot her a look as if to say, whose side are you on? But Clary ignored him. She was still watching Jace as they turned onto Kent Avenue. The lights of the bridge behind them lit his hair to an unlikely halo. She wondered if it was wrong that she was glad in some way that the men who'd taken her mother were the same men who'd killed Jace's father all those years ago. For now, at least, he'd have to help her find Jocelyn, whether he wanted to or not. For now, at least, he couldn't leave her alone. You live here? Simon stood staring up at the old cathedral with its broken-in windows and doors sealed with yellow police tape. But it's a church. Jace reached into the neck of his shirt and pulled out a brass key on the end of a chain. It looked like the sort of key one might use to open an old chest in an attic. Clary watched him curiously. He hadn't locked the door behind him when they'd left the Institute before, just let it slam shut. We find it useful to inhabit hallowed ground. I get that, but no offense, this place is a dump, Simon said, looking dubiously at the bent iron fence that surrounded the ancient building, the trash piled up beside the steps. Clary let her mind relax. She imagined herself taking one of her mother's turpentine rags and dabbing at the view in front of her, cleaning away the glamour as if it were old paint.
There it was, the true vision glowing through the false one like light through dark glass. She saw the soaring spires of the cathedral, the dull gleam of the leaded windows, the brass plate fixed to the stone wall beside the door, the Institute's name etched into it. She held the vision for a moment before letting it go, almost with a sigh. "It's a glamour, Simon," she said. "It doesn't really look like this."
"If this is your idea of glamour, I'm having second thoughts about letting you make me over."
Jace fitted the key into the lock, glancing over his shoulder at Simon.
"I'm not sure you're quite sensible of the honor I'm doing you," he said. "You'll be the first mundane who has ever been inside the Institute. Probably the smell keeps the rest of them away."
"Ignore him," Clary said to Jace and elbowed Simon in the side. "He always says exactly what comes into his head, no filters."
"Filters are for cigarettes and coffee,"
Simon muttered under his breath as they went inside.
"Two things I could use right now, incidentally."
Clary thought longingly of coffee as they made their way up a winding set of stone stairs, each one carved with a glyph. She was beginning to recognize some of them. They tantalized her sight the way half-heard words in a foreign language sometimes tantalized her hearing, as if by just concentrating harder she could force some meaning out of them. Clary and the two boys reached the elevator and rode up in silence. She was still thinking about coffee, big mugs of coffee that were half milk the way her mother would make them in the morning. Sometimes Luke would bring them bags of sweet rolls from the Golden Carriage Bakery in Chinatown. At the thought of Luke, Clary's stomach tightened, her appetite vanishing. The elevator came to a hissing stop, and they were again in the entryway Clary remembered. Jace shrugged off his jacket, threw it over the back of a nearby chair, and whistled through his teeth. In a few seconds, Church appeared, slinking low to the ground, his yellow eyes gleaming in the dusty air.
"Church," Jace said, kneeling down to stroke the cat's gray head.
"Where's Alec, Church? Where's Hodge?"
Church arched his back and meowed. Jace crinkled his nose, which Clary might have found cute in other circumstances.
"Are they in the library?"
He stood up, and Church shook himself, trotted a little way down the corridor, and glanced back over his shoulder. Jace followed the cat as if this were the most natural thing in the world, indicating with a wave of his hand that Clary and Simon were to fall in step behind him.
"I don't like cats,"
Simon said, his shoulder bumping Clary's as they maneuvered the narrow hallway.
"It's unlikely," Jace said, "knowing Church, that he likes you either."
They were passing through one of the corridors that were lined with bedrooms. Simon's eyebrows rose.
"How many people live here exactly?"
"It's an institute," Clary said, "a place where shadow hunters can stay when they're in the city, like a sort of combination safe haven and research facility."
"I thought it was a church."
"It's inside a church."
"Because that's not confusing."
She could hear the nerves under his flippant tone. Instead of shushing him, Clary reached down and took his hand, winding her fingers through his cold ones. His hand was clammy, but he returned the pressure with a grateful squeeze.
"I know it's weird," she said quietly, "but you just have to go along with it. Trust me."
Simon's dark eyes were serious.
"I trust you," he said. "I don't trust him."
He cut his glance toward Jace, who was walking a few paces ahead of them, apparently conversing with the cat.
Clary wondered what they were talking about. Politics? Opera? The high price of tuna?
"Well, try," she said. "Right now, he's the best chance I'm going to have of finding my mom."
A little shudder passed over Simon.
"This place feels not right to me," he whispered.
Clary remembered how she'd felt waking up here this morning, as if everything were both alien and familiar at the same time. For Simon, clearly, there was nothing of that familiarity, only the sense of the strange, the alien, and inimical.
"You don't have to stay with me," she said, though she'd fought Jace on the train for the right to keep Simon with her,
pointing out that after his 3 days of watching Luke, he might well know something that would be useful to them once they had a chance to break it down in detail.
"Yes," Simon said, "I do."
And he let go of her hand as they turned through a doorway and found themselves inside a kitchen.
It was an enormous kitchen, and unlike the rest of the Institute, it was all modern, with steel counters and glassed-in shelves holding rows of crockery. Next to a red cast-iron stove stood Isabel, a round spoon in her hand, her dark hair pinned up on top of her head. Steam was rising from the pot, and ingredients were strewn everywhere. Tomatoes, chopped garlic and onions, strings of dark-looking herbs, grated piles of cheese, some shelled peanuts, a handful of olives, and a whole fish, its eyes staring glassily upward.
"I'm making soup," Isabel said, waving a spoon at Jace. "Are you hungry?"
She glanced behind him then, her dark gaze taking in Simon as well as Clary.
"Oh, my God," she said with finality. "You brought another Mundy here? Hodge is going to kill you."
Simon cleared his throat.
"I'm Simon," he said.
Isabel ignored him.
"Jace Wayland," she said, "explain yourself."
Jace was glaring at the cat.
"I told you to bring me to Alec, backstabbing Judas."
Church rolled onto his back, purring contentedly.
"Don't blame Church," Isabel said. "It's not his fault Hodge is going to kill you."
She plunged the spoon back into the pot. Clary wondered what exactly peanut, fish, olive, tomato soup tasted like.
"I had to bring him," Jace said.
"Isabel, today I saw two of the men who killed my father." Isabel's shoulders tightened, but when she turned around, she looked more upset than surprised.
"I don't suppose he's one of them," she asked, pointing her spoon at Simon.
To Clary's surprise, Simon said nothing to this. He was too busy staring at Isabel, rapt and open-mouthed.
"Of course," Clary realized with a sharp stab of annoyance.
Isabel was exactly Simon's type. Tall, glamorous, and beautiful.
Come to think of it, maybe that was everyone's type.
Clary stopped wondering about the peanut fish olive tomato soup and started wondering what would happen if she dumped the contents of the pot on Isabel's head.
"Of course not," Jace said. "Do you think he'd be alive now if he were?"
Isabel cast an indifferent look at Simon.
"I suppose not," she said, absently dropping a piece of fish on the floor.
Church fell on it ravenously.
"No wonder he brought us here," said Jace disgustedly. "Ugh, I can't believe you've been stuffing him with fish again. He's looking distinctly podgy."
"He does not look podgy. Besides, none of the rest of you ever eat anything."
"I got this recipe from a water sprite at the Chelsea Market. He said it was delicious."
"If you knew how to cook, maybe I would eat," Jace muttered.
Isabel froze, her spoon poised dangerously.
"What did you say?"
Jace edged toward the fridge.
"I said I'm going to look for a snack to eat."
"That's what I thought you said."
Isabel returned her attention to the soup. Simon continued to stare at Isabel. Clary, inexplicably furious, dropped her backpack on the floor and followed Jace to the refrigerator.
"I can't believe you're eating," she hissed.
"What should I be doing instead?" he inquired with maddening calm.
The inside of the fridge was filled with milk cartons whose expiration dates reached back several weeks, and plastic Tupperware containers labeled with masking tape lettered in red ink. "Hodges, do not eat."
"Wow, he's like a crazy roommate," Clary observed, momentarily diverted.
"What, Hodge? He just likes things in order." Jace took one of the containers out of the fridge and opened it.
Spaghetti.
"Don't ruin your appetite," Isabel called.
"That," said Jace, kicking the fridge door shut and seizing a fork from a drawer, "is exactly what I intend to do."
He looked at Clary.
"Want some?"
She shook her head.
"Of course not," he said around a mouthful. "You ate all those sandwiches."
"It wasn't that many sandwiches." She glanced over at Simon, who appeared to have succeeded in engaging Isabel in conversation.
"Can we go find Hodge now?"
"You seem awfully eager to get out of here."
"Don't you want to tell him what we saw?"
"I haven't decided yet."
Jace set the container down and thoughtfully licked spaghetti sauce off his knuckle.
"But if you want to go so badly..."
"I do."
"Fine."
He seemed awfully calm, she thought. Not scary calm as he had been before, but more contained than he ought to be. She wondered how often he let glimpses of his real self peek through the facade that was as hard and shiny as the coat of lacquer on one of her mother's Japanese boxes. "Where are you going?" Simon looked up as they reached the door. Jagged bits of dark hair fell into his eyes. He looked stupidly dazed, Clary thought unkindly, as if someone had hit him across the back of the head with a 2x4. "To find Hodge," she said. "I need to tell him about what happened at Luke's." Isabel looked up. "Are you going to tell him that you saw those two men, Jace? The ones that, I don't know." He cut her off. "So keep it to yourself for now." She shrugged. "All right. Are you going to come back? Do you want any soup?" "No," said Jace. "Do you think Hodge will want any soup?" "No one wants any soup."
"I want some soup," Simon said.
"No, you don't," said Jace. "You just want to sleep with Isabel." Simon was appalled.
"That is not true."
"How flattering," Isabel murmured into the soup, but she was smirking.
"Oh, yes, it is," said Jace. "Go ahead and ask her. Then she can turn you down, and the rest of us can get on with our lives while you fester in miserable humiliation." He snapped his fingers. "Hurry up, Mundy boy. We've got work to do."
Simon looked away, flushed with embarrassment. Clary, who a moment ago would have been meanly pleased, felt a rush of anger toward Jace. "Leave him alone," she snapped. "There's no need to be sadistic just because he isn't one of you."
"One of us," said Jace, but the sharp look had gone out of his eyes. "I'm going to find Hodge. Come along or not, it's your choice."
The kitchen door swung shut behind him, leaving Clary alone with Simon and Isabel. Isabel ladled some of the soup into a bowl and pushed it across the counter toward Simon without looking at him. She was still smirking, though. Clary could feel it. The soup was a dark green color, studded with floating brown things.
"I'm going with Jace," Clary said.
"Simon?"
"I'm gonna stay here,"
he mumbled, looking at his feet.
"What?
I'm gonna stay here?" Simon parked himself on a stool.
"I'm hungry."
"Fine."
Clary's throat felt tight as if she'd swallowed something either very hot or very cold. She stalked out of the kitchen, Church slinking at her feet like a cloudy gray shadow. In the hallway, Jace was twirling one of the serif blades between his fingers. He pocketed it when he saw her.
"Kind of you to leave the lovebirds to it."
Clary frowned at him. "Why are you always such an asshat?"
"An asshat?" Jace looked as if he were about to laugh.
"What you said to Simon, I was trying to save him some pain. Isabel will cut out his heart and walk all over it in high-heeled boots. That's what she does to boys like that."
"Is that what she did to you?" Clary said, but Jace only shook his head before turning to Church.
"Hodge," he said, "and really Hodge this time. Bring us anywhere else and I'll make you into a tennis racket."
The Persian snorted and slunk down the hall ahead of them. Clary, trailing a little behind Jace, could see the stress and tiredness in the line of Jace's shoulders. She wondered if the tension ever really left him.
"Jace?" He looked at her.
"What?"
"I'm sorry for snapping at you."
He chuckled. "Which time?"
"You snap at me too, you know."
"I know," he said, surprising her.
"There's something about you that's so irritating,
unsettling."
She wanted to ask if he meant that in a good or a bad way, but didn't. She was too afraid he'd make a joke out of the answer. She cast about for something else to say.
"Does Isabel always make dinner for you?" she asked.
"No, thank God. Most of the time the Lightwoods are here, and Maris, that's Isabel's mother, she cooks for us. She's an amazing cook."
He looked dreamy, the way Simon had looked gazing at Isabel over the soup.
"Then how come she never taught Isabel?"
They were passing through the music room now, where she'd found Jace playing the piano that morning. Shadows had gathered thickly in the corners.
"Because," Jace said slowly, "it's only been recently that women have been shadow hunters along with men. I mean, there have always been women in the Clave, mastering the runes, creating weaponry, teaching the killing arts, but only a few were warriors, ones with exceptional abilities. They had to fight to be trained. Maris was part of the first generation of Clave women who were trained as a matter of course. And I think she never taught Isabel how to cook because she was afraid that if she did, Isabel would be relegated to the kitchen permanently.
Would she have been? Clary asked curiously.
She thought of Isabel in Pandemonium, how confident she'd been and how assuredly she'd used her blood-spattering whip.
Jace laughed softly. Not Isabel. She's one of the best shadow hunters I've ever known.
Better than Alec? Church, streaking soundlessly ahead of them through the gloom, came to a sudden halt and meowed. He was crouched at the foot of a metal spiral staircase that spun up into a hazy half-light overhead.
So he's in the greenhouse, Jace said.
It took Clary a moment before she realized he was speaking to the cat.
No surprise there.
The greenhouse? Clary said. Jace swung himself onto the first step.
Hodge likes it up there. He grows medicinal plants, things we can use. Most of them only grow in Idris. I think it reminds him of home.
Clary followed him. Her shoes clattered on the metal steps. Jace's didn't.
Is he better than Isabel? She asked again. Alec, I mean.
He paused and looked down at her, leaning down from the steps as if he were poised to fall. She remembered her dream. Angels falling and burning.
Better? He said. At demon slaying? No, not really. He's never killed a demon.
Really?
I don't know why not. Maybe because he's always protecting Izzy and me.
They'd reached the top of the stairs. A set of double doors greeted them, carved with patterns of leaves and vines. Jace shouldered them open. The smell struck Clary the moment she passed through the doors. A green, sharp smell. The smell of living and growing things. Of dirt and the roots that grew in dirt. She had been expecting something much smaller, something the size of the little greenhouse out behind St. Xavier's where the AP biology students cloned pea pods, or whatever it was they did. This was a huge glass-walled enclosure, lined with trees whose thickly leaved branches breathed out cool green-scented air. There were bushes hung with glossy berries, red and purple and black, and small trees hung with oddly shaped fruits she'd never seen before. Clary exhaled.
It smells like springtime, she thought, before the heat comes and crushes the leaves into pulp and withers the petals off the flowers.
Home, said Jace, to me. He pushed aside a hanging frond and ducked past it. Clary followed. The greenhouse was laid out in what seemed to Clary's untrained eye no particular pattern, but everywhere she looked was a riot of color. Blue-purple blossoms spilling down the side of a shining green hedge, a trailing vine studded with jewel-toned orange buds. They emerged into a cleared space where a low granite bench rested against the bole of a drooping tree with silvery green leaves. Water glimmered in a stone-bound rock pool. Hodge sat on the bench, his black bird perched on his shoulder. He had been staring thoughtfully down at the water but looked skyward at their approach. Clary followed his gaze upward and saw the glass roof of the greenhouse shining above them like the surface of an inverted lake.
You look like you're waiting for something,
Jace observed, breaking a leaf off a nearby bough and twirling it between his fingers. For someone who seemed so contained, he had a lot of nervous habits. Perhaps he just liked to be constantly in motion.
I was lost in thought.
Hodge rose from the bench, stretching out his arm for Hugo. The smile faded from his face as he looked at them.
What happened? You look as if you...
We were attacked, Jace said shortly.
Forsaken. Forsaken warriors? Here? Warrior, said Jace. We only saw one.
But Dorothea said there were more, Clary added.
Dorothea? Hodge held up a hand. This might be easier if you took events in order. Right.
Jace gave Clary a warning look, cutting her off before she could start talking. Then he launched into a recital of the afternoon's events, leaving out only one detail, that the men in Luke's apartment had been the same men who'd killed his father 7 years ago. Clary's mother's friend, or whatever he is, really, goes by the name Luke Garraway. Jace finished finally.
But while we were at his house, the two men who claimed they were emissaries of Valentine referred to him as Lucian Greymark.
And their names were?
Pangborn, said Jace, and Blackwell. Hodge had gone very pale. Against his gray skin, the scar along his cheek stood out like a twist of red wire.
It is as I feared, he said, half to himself. The circle is rising again.
Clary looked at Jace for clarification, but he seemed as puzzled as she was.
The circle? He said.
Hodge was shaking his head as if trying to clear cobwebs from his brain.
Come with me, he said. It's time I showed you something.
The gas lamps were lit in the library, and the polished oak surfaces of the furniture seemed to smolder like somber jewels. Streaked with shadows, the stark faces of the angels holding up the enormous desk looked even more suffused with pain. Clary sat on the red sofa, legs drawn up, Jace leaning restlessly against the sofa arm beside her.
Hodge, if you need help looking, not at all.
Hodge emerged from behind the desk, brushing dust from the knees of his trousers.
I've found it.
He was carrying a large book bound in brown leather. He paged through it with an anxious finger, blinking owl-like behind his glasses and muttering,
Where? Ah, here it is.
He cleared his throat before he read aloud.
I hereby render unconditional obedience to the circle and its principles. I will be ready to risk my life at any time for the circle in order to preserve the purity of the bloodlines of Idris and for the mortal world with whose safety we are charged.
Jace made a face. What was that from?
It was the loyalty oath of the Circle of Raziel 20 years ago,
said Hodge, sounding strangely tired.
It sounds creepy, said Clary, like a fascist organization or something.
Hodge set the book down. He looked as pained and grave as the statuary angels beneath the desk.
They were a group, he said slowly, of shadow hunters, led by Valentine, dedicated to wiping out all downworlders and returning the world to a pure state. Their plan was to wait for the downworlders to arrive in Idris to sign the accords. They must be signed again each 15 years to keep their magic potent, he added for Clary's benefit. Then they plan to slaughter them all, unarmed and defenseless. This terrible act, they thought, would spark off a war between humans and downworlders, one they intended to win.
That was the uprising, said Jace, finally recognizing in Hodge's story one that was already familiar to him.
I didn't know Valentine and his followers had a name.
The name isn't spoken often nowadays, said Hodge. Their existence remains an embarrassment to the Clave. Most documents pertaining to them have been destroyed.
Then why do you have a copy of that oath? Jace asked.
Hodge hesitated, only for a moment, but Clary saw it and felt a small and inexplicable shiver of apprehension run up her spine.
Because, he said finally, I helped write it.
Jace looked up at that.
You were in the circle? I was. Many of us were.
Hodge was looking straight ahead.
Clary's mother as well.
Clary jerked back as if he'd slapped her.
What?
I said,
I know what you said. My mother would never have belonged to something like that, some kind of hate group. It wasn't, Jace began, but Hodge cut him off.
I doubt, he said slowly, as if the words pained him, that she had much choice.
Clary stared. What are you talking about? Why wouldn't she have had a choice?
Because, said Hodge, she was Valentine's wife.
Part 2. Easy is the descent.
Facilis descensus averno. Noctes atque, dias patet atri, Ianua ditus, sed revocare gradum superasque evadre ad horas. Hoc apus, hic labor est.
Virgil, the Aeneid.
10. City of Bones. There was a moment of astonished silence before both Clary and Jace began speaking at once.
Valentine had a wife? He was married? I thought, that's impossible. My mother would never... She was only ever married to my father. She didn't have an ex-husband.
Hodge raised his hands wearily.
Children, I am not a child.
Clary spun away from the desk, and I don't want to hear any more.
Clary, said Hodge.
The kindness in his voice hurt. She turned slowly and looked at him across the room. She thought how odd it was that with his gray hair and scarred face, he looked so much older than her mother. And yet they had been young people together. Had joined the circle together, had known Valentine together.
My mother wouldn't, she began and trailed off.
She was no longer sure how well she knew Jocelyn. Her mother had become a stranger to her, a liar, a hider of secrets. What wouldn't she have done?
Your mother left the circle, said Hodge.
He didn't move toward her, but watched her across the room with a bird's bright-eyed stillness.
Once we realized how extreme Valentine's views had become, once we knew what he was prepared to do, many of us left. Lucian was the first to leave. That was a blow to Valentine. They had been very close.
Hodge shook his head.
Then Michael Wayland. Your father, Jace.
Jace raised his eyebrows but said nothing.
Then there were those who stayed loyal. Pangborn, Blackwell, the Lightwoods.
The Lightwoods? You mean Robert and Maris? Jace looked thunderstruck. What about you? When did you leave?
I didn't, said Hodge softly. Neither did they. We were afraid. Too afraid of what he might do. After the uprising, the loyalists like Blackwell and Pangborn fled. We stayed and cooperated with the Clave, gave them names, helped them track down the ones who'd run away. For that, we received clemency.
Clemency? Jace's look was quick, but Hodge saw it. He said,
You are thinking of the curse that binds me here, aren't you? You always assumed it was a vengeance spell cast by an angry demon or warlock. I let you think it, but it is not the truth. The curse that binds me was cast by the Clave.
For being in the circle? Jace asked, his face a mask of astonishment.
For not leaving it before the uprising.
But the Lightwoods weren't punished, Clary said. Why not? They'd done the same thing you'd done.
There were extenuating circumstances in their case. They were married, they had a child. Although it is not as if they reside in this outpost far from home by their own choice. We were banished here, the three of us, the four of us, I should say. Alec was a squalling baby when we left the Glass City. They can return to Idris on official business only, and then only for short times. I can never return. I will never see the Glass City again.
Jace stared. It was as if he were looking at his tutor with new eyes, Clary thought, though it wasn't Jace who had changed. He said,
The law is hard, but it is the law. I taught you that, said Hodge, dry amusement in his voice. And now you turn my lessons back at me. Rightly, too.
He looked as if he wanted to sink down into a nearby chair, but held himself upright nevertheless. In his rigid posture, there was something of the soldier he had once been, Clary thought.
Why didn't you tell me before, she said, that my mother was married to Valentine? You knew her name.
I knew her as Jocelyn Fairchild, not Jocelyn Frey, said Hodge. And you were so insistent on her ignorance of the shadow world, you convinced me it could not be the Jocelyn I knew. And perhaps I did not want to believe it. No one would wish for Valentine's return.
He shook his head again.
When I sent for the brothers of the Bone City this morning, I had no idea just what news we would have for them, he said. When the Clay finds out Valentine may have returned, that he is seeking the cup, there will be an uproar. I can only hope it does not disrupt the accords.
I bet Valentine would like that, Jace said.
But why does he want the cup so badly?
Hodge's face went gray.
Isn't that obvious? He said.
So he can build himself an army.
Jace looked startled.
But that would never—
Dinner time!
It was Isabel, standing framed in the door of the library. She still had the spoon in her hand, though her hair had escaped from its bun and was straggling down her neck.
Sorry if I'm interrupting, she added as an afterthought.
Dear God, said Jace. The dread hour is nigh. Hodge looked alarmed.
I had a very filling breakfast, he stammered. I mean lunch. A filling lunch. I couldn't possibly eat.
I threw out the soup, Isabel said, and ordered Chinese from that place downtown.
Jace unhitched himself from the desk and stretched.
Great, I'm starved.
I might be able to eat a bite, admitted Hodge meekly.
You two are terrible liars, said Isabel darkly.
Look, I know you don't like my cooking, so stop doing it, Jace advised her reasonably.
Did you order mushu pork?
You know I love mushu pork.
Isabel cast her eyes skyward. Yes, it's in the kitchen.
Awesome.
Jace ducked by her with an affectionate ruffle of the hair. Hodge went after him, pausing only to pat Isabel on the shoulder. Then he was gone, with a funny, apologetic duck of the head. Had Clary really only a few minutes before been able to see the ghost in him of his old warrior self? Isabel was looking after Jace and Hodge, twisting the spoon in her scarred, pale fingers. Clary said,
Is he really?
Isabel didn't look at her.
Is who really what?
Jace. Is he really a terrible liar? Now Isabel did turn her eyes on Clary, and they were large and dark and unexpectedly thoughtful.
He's not a liar at all. Not about important things. He'll tell you horrible truths, but he won't lie.
She paused before she added quietly,
That's why it's generally better not to ask him anything unless you know you can stand to hear the answer.
The kitchen was warm and full of light and the salt-sweet smell of takeout Chinese food. The smell reminded Clary of home. She sat and looked at her glistening plate of noodles, toyed with her fork, and tried not to look at Simon, who was staring at Isabel with an expression more glazed than the General Tso's duckling.
Well, I think it's kind of romantic, said Isabel, sucking tapioca pearls through an enormous pink straw.
What is? Asked Simon, instantly alert.
That whole business about Clary's mother being married to Valentine, said Isabel.
Jace and Hodge had filled her in, though Clary noted that both had left out the part about the Lightwoods having been in the circle and the curses the Clave had handed down. So now he's back from the dead and he's come looking for her. Maybe he wants to get back together. I kind of doubt he sent a ravener demon to her house because he wants to get back together, said Alec, who had turned up when the food was served. Nobody had asked him where he'd been, and he hadn't offered the information. He was sitting next to Jace across from Clary and was avoiding looking at her.
It wouldn't be my move, Jace agreed. First the candy and flowers, then the apology letters, then the ravenous demon hordes, in that order.
He might have sent her candy and flowers, Isabel said.
We don't know.
Isabel, said Hodge patiently, this is the man who rained down destruction on Idris, the like of which it had never seen, who set Shadow Hunter against Downworlder and made the streets of the Glass City run with blood.
That's sort of hot, Isabel argued, that evil thing.
Simon tried to look menacing, but gave it up when he saw Clary staring at him.
So why does Valentine want this cup so bad, and why does he think Clary's mom has it? He asked.
You said it was so he could make an army, Clary said, turning to Hodge.
You mean because you can use the cup to make shadow hunters?
Yes.
So Valentine could just walk up to any guy on the street and make a shadow hunter out of him, just with the cup?
Simon leaned forward.
Would it work on me?
Hodge gave him a long and measured look.
Possibly, he said. But most likely you're too old. The cup works on children.
An adult would either be unaffected by the process entirely or killed outright.
A child army, said Isabel softly.
Only for a few years, said Jace. Kids grow fast. It wouldn't be too long before they were a force to contend with.
I don't know, said Simon. Turning a bunch of kids into warriors? I've heard of worse stuff happening. I don't see the big deal about keeping the cup away from him.
Leaving out that he would inevitably use this army to launch an attack on the Clave, Hodge said dryly. The reason that only a few humans are selected to be turned into Nephilim is that most would never survive the transition. It takes special strength and resilience. Before they can be turned, they must be extensively tested. But Valentine would never bother with that. He would use the cup on any child he could capture and cull out the 20% who survived to be his army.
Alec was looking at Hodge with the same horror Clary felt. How do you know he'd do that?
Because, Hodge said, when he was in the circle, that was his plan. He said it was the only way to build the kind of force that was needed to defend our world.
But that's murder, said Isabel, who looked a little green. He was talking about killing children.
He said that we had made the world safe for humans for 1,000 years, said Hodge, and now was their time to repay us with their own sacrifice.
Their children? Demanded Jace, his cheeks flushed. That goes against everything we're supposed to be about, protecting the helpless, safeguarding humanity. Hodge pushed his plate away.
Valentine was insane, he said. Brilliant, but insane. He cared about nothing but killing demons and downworlders. Nothing but making the world pure. He would have sacrificed his own son for the cause and could not understand how anyone else would not.
He had a son, said Alec.
I was speaking figuratively, said Hodge, reaching for his handkerchief.
He used it to mop his forehead before returning it to his pocket. His hand, Clary saw, was trembling slightly.
When his land burned, when his home was destroyed, it was assumed that he had burned himself and the cup to ashes, rather than relinquish either to the Clave. His bones were found in the ashes, along with the bones of his wife.
But my mother lived, said Clary. She didn't die in that fire.
And neither, it seems now, did Valentine, said Hodge. The Clave will not be pleased to have been fooled, but more importantly, they will want to secure the cup. And more importantly than that, they will want to make sure Valentine does not.
It seems to me that the first thing we'd better do is find Clary's mother, said Jace. Find her, find the cup, get it before Valentine does. This sounded fine to Clary, but Hodge looked at Jace as if he'd proposed juggling nitroglycerin as a solution.
Absolutely not.
Then what do we do?
Nothing, Hodge said. All this is best left to skilled, experienced shadow hunters.
I am skilled, protested Jace. I am experienced. Hodge's tone was firm, nearly parental.
I know that you are, but you are still a child, or nearly one.
Jace looked at Hodge through slitted eyes. His lashes were long, casting shadows down over his angular cheekbones. In someone else, it would have been a shy look, even an apologetic one, but on Jace, it looked narrow and menacing.
I am not a child.
Hodge is right, said Alec. He was looking at Jace, and Clary thought that he must be one of the few people in the world who looked at Jace not as if he were afraid of him, but as if he were afraid for him. Valentine is dangerous. I know you're a good shadow hunter. You're probably the best our age. But Valentine's one of the best there ever was. It took a huge battle to bring him down. And he didn't exactly stay down, said Isabel, examining her forked tines. Apparently. But we're here, said Jace. We're here, and because of the Accords, nobody else is. If we don't do something...
We're going to do something, said Hodge. I'll send the Clave a message tonight. They could have a force of Nephilim here by tomorrow if they wanted. They'll take care of this. You have done more than enough.
Jace subsided, but his eyes were still glittering. I don't like it. You don't have to like it, said Alec. You just have to shut up and not do anything stupid. But what about my mother? Clary demanded.
She can't wait for some representative from the Clave to show up. Valentine has her right now. Pangborn and Blackwell said so, and he could be... She couldn't bring herself to say the word torture, but Clary knew she wasn't the only one thinking it. Suddenly, no one at the table could meet her eyes, except Simon. Hurting her, he said, finishing her sentence. Except, Clary, they also said she was unconscious and that Valentine wasn't happy about it. He seems to be waiting for her to wake up. I'd stay unconscious if I were her, Isabel muttered. But that could be any time, said Clary, ignoring Isabel. I thought the Clave was pledged to protect people. Shouldn't there be shadow hunters here right now? Shouldn't they already be searching for her? That would be easier, snapped Alec, if we had the slightest idea where to look. But we do, said Jace. You do? Clary looked at him, startled and eager. Where? Here. Jace leaned forward and touched his fingers to the side of her temple, so gently that a flush crept up her face. Everything we need to know is locked up in your head under those pretty red curls. Clary reached up to touch her hair protectively. I don't think... So what are you going to do? Simon asked sharply. Cut her head open to get at it? Jace's eyes sparkled, but he said calmly, Not at all. The Silent Brothers can help her retrieve her memories. You hate the Silent Brothers, protested Isabel. I don't hate them, said Jace candidly. I'm afraid of them. It's not the same thing. I thought you said they were librarians, said Clary. They are librarians. Simon whistled. Those must be some killer late fees. The Silent Brothers are archivists, but that is not all they are, interrupted Hodge, sounding as if he were running out of patience. In order to strengthen their minds, they have chosen to take upon themselves some of the most powerful runes ever created. The power of these runes is so great that the use of them... He broke off, and Clary heard Alec's voice in her head saying, They mutilate themselves. Well, it warps and twists their physical forms. They are not warriors in the sense that other shadow hunters are warriors. Their powers are of the mind, not the body.
They can read minds, Clary said in a small voice.
Among other things, they are among the most feared of all demon hunters.
I don't know, said Simon. It doesn't sound so bad to me. I'd rather have someone mess around inside my head than chop it off.
Then you're a bigger idiot than you look, said Jace, regarding him with scorn. Jace is right, said Isabel, ignoring Simon. The Silent Brothers are really creepy. Hodge's hand was clenched on the table.
They are very powerful, he said. They walk in darkness and do not speak, but they can crack open a man's mind the way you might crack open a walnut, and leave him screaming alone in the dark if that is what they desire.
Clary looked at Jace, appalled. You want to give me to them?
I want them to help you.
Jace leaned across the table so close she could see the darker amber flecks in his light eyes.
Maybe we don't get to look for the cup, he said softly. Maybe the Clave will do that. But what's in your mind belongs to you. Someone's hidden secrets there, secrets you can't see. Don't you want to know the truth about your own life?
I don't want someone else inside my head, she said weakly.
She knew he was right, but the idea of turning herself over to beings that even the shadow hunters thought were creepy sent a chill through her blood.
I'll go with you, said Jace. I'll stay with you while they do it.
That's enough. Simon had stood up from the table, red with anger. Leave her alone. Alec glanced over at Simon as if he'd just noticed him, raking tumbled black hair out of his eyes and blinking.
What are you still doing here, mundane?
Simon ignored him. I said, leave her alone. Jace glanced over at him, a slow, sweetly poisonous glance. Alec is right, he said. The Institute is sworn to shelter shadow hunters, not their mundane friends, especially when they've worn out their welcome. Isabel got up and took Simon's arm. I'll show him out. For a moment, it looked like he might resist her, but he caught Clary's eye across the table as she shook her head slightly. He subsided. Head up, he let Isabel lead him from the room. Clary stood up.
I'm tired, she said. I want to go to sleep.
You've hardly eaten anything, Jace protested. She brushed aside his reaching hand.
I'm not hungry.
It was cooler in the hallway than it had been in the kitchen. Clary leaned against the wall, pulling at her shirt, which was sticking to the cold sweat on her chest. Far down the hall, she could see Isabel's and Simon's retreating figures swallowed up by shadows. She watched them go silently, a shivery, odd feeling growing in the pit of her stomach. When had Simon become Isabel's responsibility instead of hers? If there was one thing she was learning from all this, it was how easy it was to lose everything you had always thought you'd have forever.
This ends Disc 4. City of Bones, Disc 5.
The room was all gold and white with high walls that gleamed like enamel and a roof high above clear and glittering like diamonds. Clary wore a green velvet dress and carried a gold fan in her hand. Her hair, twisted into a knot that spilled curls, made her head feel strangely heavy every time she turned to look behind her.
You see someone more interesting than me? Asked Simon.
In the dream, he was mysteriously an expert dancer. He steered her through the crowd as if she were a leaf caught in a river current. He was wearing all black like a shadow hunter, and it showed his coloring to good advantage. Dark hair, lightly browned skin, white teeth. He's handsome, Clary thought with a jolt of surprise.
There's no one more interesting than you, Clary said. It's just this place. I've never seen anything like it.
She turned again as they passed a champagne fountain, an enormous silver dish, the centerpiece a mermaid with a jar pouring sparkling wine down her bare back. People were filling their glasses from the dish, laughing and talking. The mermaid turned her head as Clary passed and smiled. The smile showed white teeth as sharp as a vampire's.
Welcome to the Glass City, said a voice that wasn't Simon's.
Clary found that Simon had disappeared, and she was now dancing with Jace, who was wearing white, the material of his shirt a thin cotton. She could see the black marks through it. There was a bronze chain around his throat, and his hair and eyes looked more gold than ever. She thought about how she would like to paint his portrait with the dull gold paint one sometimes saw in Russian icons. Where's Simon? She asked as they spun again around the champagne fountain. Clary saw Isabel there, and Alec, both of them in royal blue. They were holding hands like Hansel and Gretel in the dark forest.
This place is for the living, said Jace.
His hands were cool on hers, and she was aware of them in a way she had not been of Simon's. She narrowed her eyes at him.
What do you mean?
He leaned close. She could feel his lips against her ear. They were not cool at all. Wake up, Clary, he whispered. Wake up. Wake up. She bolted upright in bed, gasping, hair plastered to her neck with cold sweat. Her wrists were held in a hard grip. She tried to pull away, then realized who was restraining her.
Jace?
Yeah. He was sitting on the edge of the bed. How had she gotten into bed? Looking tousled and half awake with early morning hair and sleepy eyes.
Let go of me.
Sorry. His finger slipped from her wrists. You tried to hit me the second I said your name.
I'm a little jumpy, I guess.
She glanced around. She was in a small bedroom furnished in dark wood. By the quality of the faint light coming in through the half-open window, she guessed it was dawn or just after. Her backpack was propped against one wall.
How did I get here? I don't remember.
I found you asleep on the floor in the hallway. Jace sounded amused. Hodge helped me get you into bed. Thought you'd be more comfortable in the guest room than the infirmary.
Wow. I don't remember anything.
She ran her hands through her hair, pushing draggled curls out of her eyes.
What time is it anyway?
About 5.
In the morning?
She glared at him.
You'd better have a good reason for waking me up.
Why, were you having a good dream? She could still hear music in her ears, feel the heavy jewels brushing her cheeks.
I don't remember.
He stood up. One of the Silent Brothers is here to see you. Hodge sent me to wake you up.
Actually, he offered to wake you up himself, but since it's 5 a.m., I figured you'd be less cranky if you had something nice to look at.
Meaning you? What else?
I didn't agree to this, you know, she snapped. This silent brother thing. Do you want to find your mother, he said, or not?
She stared at him.
You just have to meet Brother Jeremiah, that's all. You might even like him. He's got a great sense of humor for a guy who never says anything.
She put her head in her hands. Get out. Get out so I can change.
She swung her legs out of bed the moment the door shut behind him. Though it was barely dawn, humid heat was already beginning to gather in the room. She pushed the window shut and went into the bathroom to wash her face and rinse her mouth, which tasted like old paper. 5 minutes later, she was sliding her feet into her green sneakers. She changed into cutoffs and a plain black t-shirt. If only her thin, freckled legs looked more like Isabel's lanky, smooth limbs. But it couldn't be helped. She pulled her hair back into a ponytail and went to join Jace in the hallway. Church was there with him, muttering and circling restlessly.
What's with the cat? Clary asked.
The silent brothers make him nervous.
Sounds like they make everyone nervous.
Jace smiled thinly. Church meowed as they set off down the hall, but didn't follow them. At least the thick stones of the cathedral walls still held some of the night's chill. The corridors were dark and cool. When they reached the library, Clary was surprised to see that the lamps were off. The library was lit only by the milky glow that filtered down through the high windows set into the vaulted roof.